I was just commenting to David Jackman that meeting all these old friends simply makes me feel old. Now it's been rubbed in because I'm dubbed an old speaker. Well, it only goes to prove that Spurgeon was right when he wrote in that chapter in his book, Lectures to My Students, on fainting fits, "Let no man who looks for ease of mind and seeks the quietude of life enter the ministry. If he does so, he will flee from it in disgust." Premature aging, I suppose, is part of the job. Dix asked me to talk a bit about the special strains that come to the minister, and we're going to do it in an expository way, befitting a conference for expository preachers. So we're going to look at the life of Moses, or some of the early part of his life anyway, in these two sessions which I'm going to share with you today and tomorrow afternoon. This afternoon I want us to scan through several chapters, Exodus 3 through 6, to remind you of the flavour of at least some of that long section of Scripture, some verses from chapter 4. I'm reading from Exodus 4, verse 10. Moses said to the Lord, "O Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you have spoken to your servant. I am slow of speech and tongue." The Lord said to him, "Who gave man his mouth? Who makes him deaf or dumb? Who gives him sight or makes him blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go, I will help you speak, and will teach you what to say." But Moses said, "O Lord, please send someone else to do it." Meet the Reverend Jones, superstar. He can preach, counsel, evangelize, administrate, conciliate, communicate, and even sometimes integrate. He can also raise the budget. He handles Sunday morning better than any quizmaster on TV. He's better with words than most political candidates. As a scholar, he surpasses many seminary professors. And no church function would be complete without his wit. Struggling, mediocre Christians look on with holy envy. Which of them would not like to be in the Reverend Jones' shoes, not to mention his parsonage? That's Howard Snyder in his book New Wineskins. Some of you may know it. He's commenting with his tongue in his cheek, of course, on the 20th century image of a successful Christian leader. He's right, of course, isn't he, when he says there is a considerable amount of what some might want to call glamour associated with the Christian ministry in the minds of an awful lot of ordinary Christian people today. To be the person who stands in the pulpit, who has his name on the headed notepaper, to have people call you pastor or reverend, it's all very intoxicating. I saw one female student very nearly faint when she was, when John Stott introduced himself to her in that self-effacing way he does at a student conference once. If it had been Michael Jackson, the effect could scarcely have been more electrifying. I thought for one heady moment I'd joined the same league myself a couple of years ago when a young lady, an overseas student in our congregation, asked me to give my signature to a book she was holding, till I looked at the cover of the book and realized that she had mistaken me for Ronald Clements, celebrated and rather liberal Old Testament lecturer in Cambridge. Sir Thomas Paine, I think, once said of Edmund Burke, "He rose like a rocket and fell like a stick." Still, I suppose to be mistaken for a Christian celebrity is fame of a sort. In my younger days, I have to admit, I did a fair bit of spiritual hero worshipping myself. I used to venerate the Christian superstars whom I heard preach and think them the most fortunate of men. And that's why, of course, I could never understand Moses. Why was he so reluctant to accept the commission God wanted to give him? What's the matter with him? I used to muse. This whole dialogue in chapters 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 is punctuated by a succession of excuses and prevarications and evasions. Lord, but this, Lord, but that. Surely God must have chosen the wrong man to encounter such obstinate unwillingness. One doesn't expect one's Christian superstars to behave in this kind of uncooperative manner. Why, I thought if God spoke to me out of a burning bush and told me to become a preacher, I wouldn't hesitate. I'd be only too thrilled to have received such a clear and unambiguous mandate for my ministry. But that, I stress, is what I used to think. Back in those days before I did receive a call to the Christian ministry myself. These days my criticisms of Moses are a little more muted. I realize now that only the very young and naive Christian jumps up and down with excitement at the prospect of being a leader among God's people. The wisdom of years counsels a more sober and cautious response. I don't blame Moses any longer for being reluctant. Sometimes I wish I'd had enough wisdom to be a little more reluctant myself. Oh, it's true, Moses may have gone a little bit over the top in his unwillingness to accept God's call. The text does say in verse 14 of chapter 4, God eventually got angry with him. But if it was necessary to err in such a situation, I suspect Moses was erring on the right side. Better by far to be a reluctant conscript to spiritual leadership than an over-eager volunteer. This afternoon, then, I want us to look at chapters 3 to 6 of Exodus in order to identify three areas of discouragement which conspired to make Moses a reluctant prophet. I think there may be some amongst us, still a little wet behind the ears, who need, maybe, to become a little more realistic about what spiritual leadership is all about in the church. And those of us maybe who are not so wet behind the ears, maybe we need lifting up a little bit to be reassured that the reluctance, the discouragements, the disappointments, the depressions that we sometimes suffer in the ministry don't necessarily mean we're forever out of the superstar bracket, for even Moses felt like it. Well then, let's look at the three areas of discouragement I want to draw your attention to. The first, an overwhelming sense of personal inadequacy. That in chapter 3 and the early part of chapter 4. Second, the emotional cost to our personal relationships. That, I think, comes out of a rather strange incident in the middle of chapter 4. And third, the humiliating experience of personal rejection and disappointment in the ministry. That in chapters 5 and 6. First of all then, let's focus on Moses' own personality and the sources of discouragement that arose out of that. His sense of inadequacy to lead. All summed up in that verse we read. Oh Lord, please send someone else to do it. Youthful exuberance is willing to believe itself omnipotent. But the mature man is humble enough to recognize his limitations. Moses was now a mature man, and he had doubts about himself. He could think of lots better qualified people than he was for the job of being God's prophet. Send somebody else, he advises the Lord. If we look back over chapters 3 and 4, we can identify what lay behind these inadequacy feelings. They're not rare in any of us. For a start, there was personal modesty. 3:11. Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" Let's face it, God, humanly speaking, I'm a crazy choice. Whatever prestige I once enjoyed in Pharaoh's court was forfeited years ago when I stupidly murdered that Egyptian and fled the country. The chances are nobody but my own family would even remember me in Egypt these days. I would be a total stranger, even to the Israelites I'm supposed to be liberating. And what do I know about politics or military strategy? I've been a shepherd for the last 40 years. No, Lord, you've made a mistake. I'm not important enough for a job like this. Secondly, there was a sense of theological ignorance. I think that's what we ought to interpret 3:13 as. Suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, "The God of your fathers has sent me to you," and they ask me, "What is his name?" Then what shall I tell them? Moses, of course, isn't just asking here for some label to hang on God when he asks for his name. He's confessing his lack of theological knowledge, of religious education. What do I know about the God of Israel, he's saying? I've been living with pagan Midianites all these years. It's as much as I can do to remember the stories of the patriarchs that my mother taught me when I was little. Surely there must be somebody with a doctorate in divinity who can communicate your message much more faithfully and reliably than ever I could. Thirdly, we note a fear of failure. 4:1. What if they do not believe me or listen to me and say, "The Lord didn't appear to you"? I suspect the memory of that time when, as a young man, he had unsuccessfully tried to intervene in a dispute between two of his Jewish brothers. I suspect that cast a long shadow in Moses' mind. "I've got no leadership charisma," he says. "I made a real blunder then. If I go to those Israelites with some cock and bull story about a burning bush, they'll just laugh at me, just as they did before. They'll write me off as a religious crank." In 4:10, we see that he also felt a lack of appropriate gifts. "Oh Lord, I've never been eloquent, neither in the past nor since you have spoken to your servant. I'm slow of speech and tongue." Everybody knows, God, that if you're going to stir up political and religious feeling, you've got to be an orator. "And I'm hopeless at public speaking," says Moses. "Always have been. Why, just listen to me now. I can't even hold a conversation with you, Lord, without stammering and hesitating all the time." And so finally we come to what I think one can only call moral cowardice. In 4:13, "Lord, please send someone else to do it." One thing Moses did know firsthand was the might of Egypt. He knew the devastating dimensions of the liberation God was suggesting. He knew the political barriers that would have to be overcome, the armed chariots that would have to be faced, the geographical terrain that would have to be crossed. And Moses was no longer a headstrong stripling. He was middle-aged, even perhaps a little beyond middle-age. He didn't want lots of change any longer. He didn't want lots of excitement in life. He was a family man now. He had a couple of children to bring up. It was time to settle down, not to go gallivanting off all over the countryside, freedom fighting. He didn't have the heart for such activities any longer, or the nerve. So personal modesty, theological ignorance, fear of failure, lack of gifts, moral cowardice. No, all ways round it was clear God had made a dreadful mistake. He'd called the wrong man. There were dozens of more suitable candidates. Moses' response to God took the form ours so often does. "Lord, here am I. Send him." Lord, I'm too shy. Send him. Lord, I haven't got the qualifications. Send him. Lord, I've got other commitments. Send him. Lord, I'm scared stiff. Send him. The excuses never change. A sense of inadequacy is something all of us experience when God breaks in on our life and threatens to turn them upside down by a call to the ministry. Indeed, it's something which Spurgeon testifies to very graphically in that chapter we mentioned from his lectures. When I first became a pastor in London, the thought of that career, which seemed to open up so far from elating me, he says, cast me into the lowest depths. Who was I that I should continue to lead so great a multitude? I would betake me to my village obscurity, or emigrate to America, and find a solitary nest in the backwoods, where I might be sufficient for the things which would be demanded of me. Not the first or the last preacher who's decided emigration to America was better than facing the rigours of ministry in his homeland. Maybe some of us here feel inadequate to face the challenge God puts before us. Well, if so, we have got something in common with a superstar. Not just Spurgeon. Moses. He felt just the same. Maybe that in itself is a comfort to us. But that wasn't the end of the discouragements that made matters so bad for Moses. A second area also arose very quickly after he received his call. Not just from his own personality, but from his family context. And that brings us to the second thing I wanted to talk about, the emotional cost in the area of the minister's personal relationships. It introduces us to a very strange little interlude, the narrative of which begins in 4 verse 18. Moses went back to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, "Let me go back to my own people in Egypt to see if any of them are still alive." Very significant, I think, that Moses mentioned nothing of his experience at the burning bush to his father-in-law. Instead, he gives the impression that this journey back to Egypt is occasioned by nothing more than family sentiment or family loyalty. The only explanation for this subterfuge, I think, must be that Moses anticipated some resistance from his in-laws to the mission God had given him. You've got to remember that Jethro, his father-in-law, was a pagan, and a pretty committed pagan. Chapter 2, verse 16, describes him as the priest of Midian, which strongly suggests he exercised some official role in the local cult of his desert community. It's true he was later converted to faith in Jehovah. We read about it in Exodus 18, and we will probably look at it again tomorrow afternoon. But at this point in the story, Moses may well have judged that the elder of his wife's clan would not look favorably on the thought of his son-in-law embracing a rival deity to his own. In fact, you know, we don't even know for sure whether Moses had ever confessed his Israelite origins to his Midianite in-laws. When he arrived among the Midianites back in chapter 2, verse 19, Jethro's daughters took him to be a fugitive Egyptian, fooled no doubt by the distinctive dress and hairstyle that had marked him out as a prince of Pharaoh's court. And there's nothing at all to indicate that Moses had ever disillusioned them on that point. In fact, the name he gives his firstborn son seems rather to suggest that he had indeed abandoned his Israelite ethnic origins and accepted a new identity amongst this semi-nomadic tribe into which he had married. He called him Gershom because, he said, "I have become an alien in a foreign land." And I think further confirmation of this repudiation of his Israelite heritage is afforded by our discovery in chapter 4, verse 25, that Moses had never circumcised his son, Gershom. From the days of Abraham, this had been an important Hebrew cultural distinctive. But apparently it wasn't practiced by the Midianites, and Moses chose to conform to their tradition on this point, rather than that of his own people. Thus, in effect, saying he regarded his son as a Midianite, rather than as an Israelite. Now, I want to suggest to you it was this betrayal of his Israelite roots which lies behind the extraordinary incident which occurred once Moses and his family were en route back to Egypt. It is an extraordinary little episode, and we read about it from verse 24 of chapter 4. At a lodging place on the way, the Lord met Moses and was about to kill him. But Zipporah took a flint knife, cut off her son's foreskin, and touched Moses' feet with it. "Surely you are a bridegroom of blood to me," she said. Now, you will know that huge debate has been spent on these verses. The account is so abbreviated and so cryptic, it affords endless opportunity for a scholarly speculation, much of which is unconvincing, even more of which is, or even less of which is open to verification. Any solution we propose has to be no more than a suggestion, I think. But expository preachers have to beware of ducking the difficult verses, don't they? So let me suggest to you at least one possible interpretation of what's going on here. The clue for me, I think, lies in identifying the two unanswered questions these strange verses present. First, why did the Lord threaten Moses' life? Quite apart from the absence of any motive for such an action in the verses themselves, it seems monstrously inconsistent with the fact that the Lord had just appointed him to do a vital task. And we know God works in mysterious ways. But it's hard to believe even he could be so illogical as to make a man a prophet one day and then try to assassinate him the next. The only solution to that dilemma I find, which is in the least satisfying, is to side with that very considerable number of scholars who believe that this attack was not in fact directed at Moses at all, but at Gershom, Moses' son. See, although the word Moses appears in our English text in verse 24 and 25, it doesn't appear in the Hebrew text. The NIV has added the word Moses in an attempt to clarify the meaning, as in the way of translations, as compounded the confusion, I think, thereby. What the text actually says is, the Lord met him and was about to kill him, but Zipporah took a flint knife and cut off her son's foreskin and touched his feet with it. When you read it like that, it could just as easily be his son, Gershom, that is being referred to throughout. And if that is so, of course, the intelligibility of the passage immediately is improved, for a logical link becomes apparent with the concluding words of verse 23, which introduce the episode. "Let my son go so that he may worship me, but you refuse to let him go, so I will kill your firstborn son." Gershom, remember, was Moses' firstborn son. That brings us to the second unanswered question these strange verses present. How did Zipporah know what to do in order to avert the threat to her son's life? Well, here again, we can't be certain, but the only explanation that carries much conviction with me is that she and Moses must have spoken about the issue of circumcision on the journey. No doubt the thought had early occurred to Moses that if he was going to obey God and return to his ancestral roots, then the uncircumcision of his sons would have to be regularized in order to permit their acceptance within the covenant community of Israel. All the more urgent was this when God revealed to him, in verse 23, that non-Israelite firstborn sons would be in jeopardy when the divine fury was let loose on Pharaoh. So my guess is that soon after they left Jethro, Moses broached this subject with his wife. Gershom ought to be circumcised before we get to Egypt, he said to her. It's important. I think it's very likely that Zipporah was strongly opposed to the idea. Indeed, reading a little between the lines, it wouldn't surprise me if they had one almighty row about it. I doubt whether Zipporah was ever really convinced of the need to leave her own family in Midian in the first place. It's never hard for a wife to uproot from her parental family. And that her husband should return after a trip in the desert with some strange story about a burning bush, and then say within the next week or so we're going to emigrate to some distant land, well, one could not blame Zipporah if she felt slightly perplexed. And that Moses should now be demanding that her son submit to a foreign and very possibly repugnant ritual. Well, I suspect that may very well have been the last straw. No doubt Moses stressed how he feared for the life of his two sons, and particularly for Gershom, the firstborn, unless he was protected by this sign of covenant blood as God had revealed to him. But I suspect Zipporah was no more impressed by Moses' talk of divine revelation than her father had been. And it was at that point of domestic impasse that God stepped in, and as the narrator put it, he met Gershom and tried to kill him. Was it a sudden illness, or was it even perhaps a foretaste of that horror of Passover night? We can only guess. Suffice it to say that Zipporah was no longer in any doubt as to the cause of the danger. Moses, irritating though it was to admit it, had been telling the truth. This newfangled God he found in the desert really did have it in for firstborn children. She took a flint knife, cut off her son's foreskin, and touched his feet with it. "Surely you are a bridegroom of blood to me," she said. The sign then of covenant blood averts the angel of death from her child, just as that sign would avert disaster from the children of Israel in a few months' time at Passover. It was a fascinating anticipation of what was to come. It must have impressed and illumined Moses' understanding enormously. But Zipporah, in her anger and disgust with her husband, was not appeased in the slightest by this happy outcome. "You are a bridegroom of blood," she says to him. Whatever exactly that proverb means, I think it is clear that she was hostile towards Moses as a result of this incident. Indeed, we're not guessing there. There's further evidence of it. For if you look on to chapter 18, verse 2, we read a very strange verse again. "After Moses had sent away his wife Zipporah, his father-in-law Jethro received her and her two sons, Gershom and Eliezer." That verb "sent away" regularly carries the force of divorce in a marital context in the Old Testament. It seems clear then that there was a very profound rift between Moses and his wife after their departure from Midian and before their arrival in Egypt. So much so that she and the children went back to her parental family, to Jethro, as a result. At what precise point this marital separation took place, we're not told, but I think it's far from impossible that it was a direct outcome of this strange incident that we read about involving the circumcision of Gershom. For we hear nothing more of Zipporah or her sons from that point until this reconciliation in Exodus 18, 14 chapters later. Now, at the risk of being accused of reading a bit too much into the verses, I want to suggest to you that this represents a startling example of the way in which a call to the ministry has ramifications in the family of a man. Sometimes horrendous ramifications. The cost which a man must be willing sometimes to pay in his personal relationships can be acute. It is a very hard thing to be the marital partner of a Christian leader. And some people never fully adjust to it. Look at it from Zipporah's point of view. She was a pagan at this time. How could she possibly sympathize with her husband's spiritual vocation? All these years Moses had lived with her, he'd been content for his son to be raised as a Midianite. How could he expect her to suddenly accept that there was going to be a switch in nationalities? Now, these problems, of course, have their Christian counterpart. It's difficult enough when a committed Christian wife has to come to terms with the fact that her husband has received a call to the ministry. But if she is perhaps less committed than he is, it can put an extraordinary strain on the marriage. There are some people who just can't cope with the position of being a minister's wife or the other half of a missionary couple. And sometimes relationships break as a result of this. Zipporah had a choice. Either she went on with Moses or she stayed home with Jethro and the kids. And the same choice faces countless wives and fiancés when their partner or future partner encounters a burning bush. Now, I don't want to be misunderstood. I'm not in any way condoning clerical divorce. But we do have to face up to the statistics of clerical divorce and of marital disharmony within the ministry. Do not suppose I've come to bring peace on earth, said Jesus. A man's enemies shall sometimes be members of his own household. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, wife and children, brother and sisters, he can't be my disciple, he said. I am quite sure there are men amongst us today whose heart goes out to Moses in this situation. And I'm quite sure there would be even more of our wives whose hearts would go out to Zipporah in this situation. If we knew the likely cost of Christian leadership upon our families and particularly upon our marital partners, we would be reluctant to undertake it. And there's more than one man who, having put his hand to the plough, has looked back, because the realities of this have dawned upon him. So there's a sense of personal inadequacy that arises from our own psychology, our own personality. There is a cost to pay, too, within the family circle. But thirdly, there is perhaps the most profound discouragement of all. The experience of rejection and disappointment with the very people to whom we're called to minister. Look on to chapter 5, verse 22 and 23. Moses returned to the Lord and said, O Lord, why have you brought trouble upon this people? Is this why you sent me? Ever since I went to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has brought trouble upon this people, and you have not rescued your people at all. A famous American football star called Billy Vaughn once said that it wasn't a bad idea to lose a few games early in the football season because it saved you from the psychological pressure of having to defend an undefeated record. Which may be so, provided those losses don't so demoralize the team, they become psychologically incapable of victory. Moses certainly seems to have got pretty close to such a defeatist mentality as a result of his early disappointments. Everything had started out quite optimistically, you see. He found Aaron, his brother, and got a warm reception from him, and together they'd gone to the Israelite elders, and again the response had been encouraging initially. In 4, verse 30, he told them everything the Lord had said to them. He performed the signs before the people, and they believed. And when they heard the Lord was concerned about them and had seen their misery, they bowed down and worshipped. So far, so good. Then, with the elders of the people behind him, Moses embarks on his first session of negotiations with Pharaoh. 5 verse 1. Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and said, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says, let my people go so they may hold a festival to me in the desert." It's not hard to imagine the electricity in the atmosphere as Moses speaks those words. The Israelites wait with bated breath. Here's the crunch. God has said he will deliver his people. Go to Pharaoh and tell him so. Okay, we've done it, Lord. Now it's over to you. Then horror of horrors. The Lord seems to have taken a vacation. Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey him and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord. I will not let Israel go." Like an early trade unionist, Moses finds the workers' demands are rejected by the management with contemptuous derision. Instead of the concessions being granted, more stringent regulations are imposed. In a cruel and despotic attempt to nip this dangerous innovation of organized labor in the bud. Verse 6. Pharaoh gave this order to the slave drivers and foremen in charge of the people. "You're no longer to supply the people with straw for making bricks. Let them go and gather their own straw, but require them to make the same number of bricks as before. Don't reduce the quota. They're lazy. That's why they're crying out, 'Let us go and sacrifice to our God.' Make the word harder for the men so they keep working and pay no attention to lies." So the morale of the Israelites plummets like a stone, and Moses' popularity slumps with it. Verse 19. The Israelite foremen realized they were in trouble when they were told, "You're not to reduce the number of bricks required of you for each day." And when they left Pharaoh, they found Moses and Aaron waiting to meet them, and they said, "May the Lord look upon you and judge you. You've made us a stench to Pharaoh and his servants, and have put a sword in their hand to kill us." It's a shattering thing for the man of God, having been convinced of his call and of his message, to find things don't go immediately the way he expected them to. God's work requires patience and persistence. Moses should have known that. In fact, God had told him that Pharaoh's initial reaction would be very negative. He told him it would require a great display of his judgments against Egypt before Pharaoh could be coerced into releasing Israel. And Moses, like all of us, forgot that. He forgot it because he didn't really want to hear it. We have a vision of how God's going to work, how the church must grow and develop. And because our hopes don't materialize immediately, we're discouraged. While we say things are getting worse, not better, we sit with our head in our hands and weep with frustration. Everything's gone wrong. And then, of course, back sweeps all our old self-doubt. "Why have you brought trouble upon this people? Is this why you sent me? Ever since I went to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he has brought trouble upon this people, and you haven't rescued your people at all. Why did you send me in the first place? God, I told you I'd be no good. Why didn't you send that other person?" It wouldn't have been so bad if the resolve of the Israelites hadn't been so quickly undermined. But just when Moses most needed the support and the encouragement of the elders of the people, they deserted him. And no amount of spiritual exhortation would change their attitude. See verse 6 of chapter 6. "Say to the Israelites, 'I am the Lord. I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will flee you from being slaves to them and will redeem you with an outstretched arm.'" Verse 9, Moses reported this to the Israelites, but they didn't listen to him because of their discouragement and their cruel bondage. They'd listened to that message at first. This new preacher with unusual gifts and exciting messages. But people are fickle, you see. They judge by performance. They weren't interested in Moses' theology. They wanted a bit of prosperity doctrine. That's what they wanted. A bit of health and wealth for all. Name it and claim it stuff. All these things Moses was talking about, they wanted them now. None of this waiting, Moses. They weren't interested in the burning bush. They'd had their liberation hopes fired and they wanted the satisfaction of them. So when things took a turn for the worse, they dropped Moses like a hot potato. And frankly, there's nothing very unusual about that. I'll tell you something. All over this country, there are pastorless churches. Hundreds of them, thousands of them. Yet in spite of the fact there are all those pastorless churches, every year men leave the ministry. Good men. Talented men. Men with vision. Men in their prime. Men who could help fill those pastorless pulpits. Wouldn't you like to know why those churches are pastorless? Why those ministers are leaving? Well, I'll tell you. Disappointment. That's the reason. Disappointment that change doesn't come quickly enough. Disappointment that hearts are hard and conversions few. Saddest of all, disappointment with God's people. No, not with non-Christian people, not with people outside the church. Disappointment with church people. The very people who ought to have had the best interests of the kingdom of God at heart. But people who all too often, I'm afraid, if the truth were known, would rather have a graduate from Dale Carnegie's Institute than a man with a burning bush in his experience. People want a superstar. They want an entertainer. Does he know how to win friends and influence people? Does he project the right kind of PR image? Can he make the church grow numerically? Can he push the offerings up? Can he keep his sermons short? Can he make our church a success, the envy of all the other churches around? People like this are impressed by worldly things. And that worldly, secularized attitude has compromised many, many of our evangelical churches today. So that people are looking for all the wrong things in the ministry. And they're not without people to encourage them in looking for those wrong things. You may think there's a trace of bitterness in what I'm about to say. I assure you there is absolutely none. But I have had opportunity now for 20 years to look at churches. And my observation is that by and large, churches do not support their pastors. So long as they are successful, they may patronize their minister. If he becomes famous, they may be very glad to bathe in his reflected reputation. But let him fail. Let his vision suffer a setback. Let his health decline. Let his popularity fall. And the grumbling will begin. And the fifth columnists in the church's back benches will start their gossiping. And the complaints will begin to whine. And the patronage will cease. And the Christian leader, just like Moses, is left alone. Loneliness is an occupational hazard of the ministry at the best of times. Precisely because we are in the ministry. We cannot really share profoundly and intimately with many people. But when we lose not just the fellowship of our church, but their sympathy and support too. That loneliness becomes quite intolerable. If the football team isn't winning, fire the manager. That's the attitude, isn't it? Moses is left alone, discouraged, hurt, disillusioned. I have met many men who feel just like that, destroyed by their own churches. We can perhaps overcome our sense of personal inadequacy. We can maybe cope with the inevitable cost to our family relationships and even our marriages of being in the ministry. But when the support of God's people is lost, the very people we're supposed to be ministering to, what is there to do but resign, give up the job, throw in the towel, surrender to the failure we feel? There are always other things we can do. We can be insurance salesmen. We can even become lecturers at theological colleges. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Go, tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to let the Israelites go out of his country." But Moses said to the Lord, "If the Israelites won't listen to me, then why on earth should Pharaoh listen to me? Since I speak with faltering lips." Here it is then. God's prophet, tortured with feelings of inadequacy, broken-hearted by the devastation of his family, shattered most of all by the failure of his hopes and by the disloyalty of the people. How can you really blame him for being a reluctant prophet? And yet, of course, the thing we have to get hold of this afternoon is this, isn't it? That the story of Moses is not the story of a man who gave up. It's the story of one of the greatest spiritual leaders the people of God have ever known. How did this jumble of inferiority and pessimism and defeatism triumph over his discouragements and become a superstar? That's a big question, isn't it? Did he go to some special church growth course at Fuller Seminary? Did he read some How to Do It book published by Mission England? Was he filled with the Spirit at some seaside jamboree? What was the secret that turned Moses, the reluctant leader, into Moses, the effective leader? Well, it's nothing very novel or world-shattering. In fact, it was there right from the very first hesitation he gave voice to. Look back at chapter 3, verse 11. Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" And God said, "I will be with you." God could have encountered Moses at the burning bush in his youth. And I've no doubt if he had done, Moses would have reacted with the same passion and impetuosity as when he murdered that Egyptian. But God waited till that youthful idealism had subsided. He waited till life had taught Moses a measure of self-doubt, a tinge of cynicism. He didn't meet him in the rash enthusiasm of youth, but in the sober reluctance of middle age. And I suspect God did that with a purpose. Because many things can motivate a man into the ministry, especially in his youth. A sense of romance, a desire for esteem, an extrovert exhibitionism, an idealistic humanitarianism, a super-spiritual pietism. There are some people I know who go into the Church of England just because they like dressing up. Now, many things can make a person willing to be a minister. But only one thing can keep him one. And that is an overwhelming conviction about the presence of God in his life. I will be with you. Simple words, almost trite, you could say. God be with you is a meaningless cliche in most people's vocabulary, isn't it? But rightly understood, you see, those five little words are spiritual dynamite. I will be with you. Who is that I? Why, it's God, the I am who I am. The God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. The Lord Jehovah, that's who it is. And who is that you? Why, it's Moses. Inadequate, defeated, demoralized, reluctant Moses. I will be with you. Moses in his modesty complains, he's nobody special. God in his condescension answers, on the contrary, Moses, you're somebody very special. I will be with you. Do you lack theological understanding? Then I will reveal my name to you and give you a message to preach, he says. Do you fear failure? Then I will clothe your ministry in authority. Men will believe and pay attention to you. Do you lack spiritual gifts of utterance? But I, the Lord, gave man his mouth. I will teach you what to say. Do you cower in cowardice? Then I will give you a colleague, Aaron, your brother, to support you in the ministry. Doesn't matter what objection you raise, Moses, I've got an answer for it. You see, I will be with you. No matter what inadequacy you feel, what relationships you must sacrifice, what disappointments you suffer. I am who I am, unchangeably real in the experience of my people, and I will be with you. God, you see, is surrounding the fragility of Moses' weakness with the barricade of his invincible ego. I will be with you. I assure you, there is nothing at all essentially unspiritual about reluctance. If God has called us to the ministry, well then, in the words of Churchill in the 1940s, I have nothing to offer you but blood, toil, tears and sweat. That's what it's like in the ministry, for all of us. Accept God's vocation in your life and you will have discouragements. Personal inadequacy will haunt you. You'll never feel sufficient for the job. Sometimes your family relationships will go askew and you'll feel overwhelmed with guilt at the burden you're laying on your wife or on your children. Most of all, there'll be disappointment with the Christian people God sends you to when they prove disloyal or treacherous. You'll experience all these things. Everybody who's been called by God has experienced them. That's why, if we're wise, we will be reluctant. Read your Bible and you will find it's God's regular policy to choose people who are realistic enough about these things to be reluctant. Gideon and Jeremiah and Moses. They all felt unwilling for the charge that God wanted to bring into their lives. And they told God so. Some, like Jonah, even tried to run away from the job. Even the very best of them was found one night bathed in agony, saying, Father, if it be possible, take this cup from me. Now, believe me, there is nothing unspiritual about reluctance. But let's be sure of this too. There is an answer to it. God says to us, as he said to Moses, I will be with you, overruling your personal inadequacy, compensating for your personal sacrifices, comforting your personal disappointments. Oh, it may be a hard and costly path to tread, but Christian ministry has one overwhelming advantage. We do not tread it alone. I will be with you. You see the certainty of that? The Master didn't say, go into all the world and preach the gospel and I will keep an occasional eye on your progress. No, he says, I will be with you, even to the end of the world. And faith surely means allowing that I will to overrule the I can't of our excuses. Of course we don't feel like a superstar. Then neither did Moses. The point is the promise of God's presence in our life enough to make us say yes? Well, let's pray together as we bring our afternoon session to a conclusion. Some words of Jeremiah. Lord, you deceived me, and I was deceived. I'm ridiculed all day long, everyone mocks me. The word of the Lord has brought me insult and reproach. But if I say I will not mention him or speak any more in his name, his word is in my heart like a burning fire. The Lord is with me like a mighty warrior. Father, we freely confess that when we come to a gathering like this, we are strongly tempted to project an image of triumph and success to those around us. We want to be well thought of. We don't want to expose the chinks in our armor, the pain in our heart. Lord, we want to pray this afternoon that, encouraged by the candor of your word about this greatest of all your servants, Moses, help us to be honest with one another and with you. Help us, Lord, to use this unusual opportunity when we meet together as ministers of your word to speak frankly to one another about the discouragement we feel, about the hurts we've suffered, about the doubts we're entertaining. So, Lord, grant that as you send us back, it may be not just with minds better informed or spirits stirred up, but, Lord, with our reluctance transformed into a new willingness. For Jesus' sake. Amen.